Welcome to New Thinking for a New World, a Tilburg Foundation podcast. I am Alan Stoga, your host. Each week, I bring you conversations with people who think differently about the great issues that are shaping our world. Geopolitics, disruptive tech, mass migration, the changing climate, culture wars, all of it is grist for our mill. I hope you enjoy listening. I also hope you will let me know what you think and that you join the conversation at tilburgfoundation.org. And now for today's episode of New Thinking for a New World. Hello and welcome to today's webinar, which is a collaboration between the Green Mountain Academy for Lifelong Learning and the Tilburg Foundation. Does Congress matter? Normally, that's a simple question. But as the Trump presidency unfolds, there is no normal and nothing simple anymore. President Trump obviously has an expansive view of presidential power, and he is intent on exercising it at the expense of the Congress and of the courts. So does Congress matter is becoming a huge question, potentially the stuff of constitutional crisis, and that's what we're going to talk about today. My guest for that conversation is Tom O'Donnell. Tom was the longtime Democratic leader Dick Gephardt's chief of staff when he was in the Congress and has spent much of his professional career, Tom's that is, either working on Capitol Hill or as an academic teaching about Congress, about politics, and about the United States. He is an insider's insider when it comes to understanding how the Congress works, or maybe I should say how it used to work. Welcome, Tom.
Thanks, Alan. Glad to be with you.
Let's get started at 60,000 feet. The last Congress, the 118th, passed the fewest laws since any Congress since the 80s. The current Congress, the 119th, looks like it wants to challenge that record and do even less work, at least as measured by producing laws. My question, Tom, why is Congress missing in action?
I don't know if I'd necessarily say they're missing in action. First off, let me start. The framers, when they put together the Congress and the government, they decided that they would rather have 535 individuals in a room rather than one person making the decision. And let me just say, from my years both working in the leadership in the Congress and then also from outside working with the Congress, it is very, very difficult to get 535 people to manage this legislation and pass bills. And so we used to think that the process was majestic when we got big paces of legislation done. We just couldn't believe it. We got it done because of what we were up against. And so it's 530, 435 in the House, 100 in the Senate. And in the Senate, you need 60%. Not a simple majority, but you need 60% on most legislation. So it is a very, very difficult thing to do. And with people from all different backgrounds, all different parts of the country, representing all different opinions, it is it's a Herculean task to get legislation done. I'll say that at the outset. Second point, why is it so few now? Well, one of the things we have now is the Congress is extremely competitive. The margins in both the House and the Senate are pretty small. And if you look at the last 10 years in the House and the Senate, Republicans have run the House for 6 out of the 10 years and Democrats 4. And in the Senate, the Democrats have run the Senate for 6 years and the Republicans for 6 cycles and the Republicans 4 cycles, 4 Congresses. And so it is very, very tight margins. And with tight margins, what we've ended up with is an awful lot of polarization too, because every 2 years we have an extremely competitive race for the House and the Senate. And the leadership and others are spending a lot of time worrying about, A, how am I going to keep the majority, or B, how am I going to break out from the minority and take the majority back? And an enormous amount of time is taking place doing that. And the polarization, they don't want to work with each other. because they think in 2 years they're possibly going to be in the majority, and they don't want to do anything to give the majority, current majority, a hand to get stuff done. So there's not a lot of bipartisanship because of the political situation we find ourselves in.
One of the consequences of that is that the public's view of the Congress has more or less collapsed. Last poll I saw said something like 28% of only 28% of Americans approve of the Congress, of what it's doing, how it operates. The amazing thing about that number, two aspects that are amazing, as you know. One is that 28 is a terribly low number.
Correct.
The other is that it was as low as 17% last year. So somebody in this country thinks that the Congress is becoming more effective over the last month or two.
I would say that is the hope on the part of particularly Republicans in the country who see their party controlling the House, the Senate, and the White House, and they think that perhaps they're going to be able to get stuff done. So if there's a small uptick, I would attribute it to that.
Get stuff done. That is sort of the job. Getting stuff done is what people want, and that's pretty clear. And as you said earlier, it's getting harder and harder to get stuff done. Doesn't that, maybe we go right to the L word. Isn't that about leadership? You worked for a great leader. Dick was a very effective politician. He fought like a dog for what he believed in. You know this better than I. And he was a Democrat through and through, but he also knew he had to legislate. And he worked not just to get his opinion affected, but to get legislation. Why has that disappeared? Is it about the leadership today?
Yes, I think it still is. And we can just go back to 3 years ago in the 21-22, when Biden came in. And lo and behold, and people probably wouldn't believe this, but they ended up doing an awful lot of bipartisan legislation. They were able to pass a infrastructure bill. People had talked about getting an infrastructure bill done for years, but in a bipartisan way, they passed an infrastructure bill. They also passed a gun control bill that would incentivize local communities to use the red flag law. And they also passed a CHIPS and Science Act, bipartisan, all three. So, yes, I still think it can get done. But it's really, really hard when you have the electoral situation of every 2 years, it is extremely competitive. And with a party, you know, one of the key things they want to do is get back in the majority and try to get their policies through.
You're a Democrat, but I'm going to ask you about the Republicans because they have controlled the House, as you said, 6 of the 10 cycles. And we've seen some amazing intramurals within the Republican Party in the House. Leaders voted out, leaders going to multiple rounds to get elected, making all sorts of deals, much of which I suspect we don't know the nature of the deal. Why would anyone want to be Speaker of the House of Representatives today?
Anybody who attempts to take the speakership, I believe when they look in the mirrors, they say, I can do this job. I'm going to make a difference. And I think they all go into that expecting that they've got the skills as a leader to bring that caucus together and actually then produce legislation that would help the American public. I mean, you can't go into the job or attempt to become speaker without having confidence in your abilities, I think, to get things done. And so that's just the way people who run for leadership, they think they can really make a difference.
You spent several years working with Congressman Gephardt in his leadership role.
Yep.
If you are today, you're not quite wearing red, but we can pretend that's a red jacket you've got on.
Okay.
If you were today on that side of the aisle, what would you advise? How would you advise a speaker to go back to what you said earlier, get stuff done? And Kenny?
Well, so this speaker, I would say, has been pretty agile. He comes in after Kevin McCarthy could no longer hold the speakership. And I don't know, he was probably the fourth, fifth, or sixth person into the race, and they finally decided on Johnson. in the last Congress, he spent most of his time, when he had to get stuff done, he worked with the Democrats. There is a group of Republicans who, you know, as John Boehner, the former speaker, had said, they don't really want to govern. They want to, you know, put out press releases, but they don't really want to govern. And, you know, Johnson basically said, you know, the last 2 years, 23, 24, hey, I got to get some stuff done. I'm going to do it with the Democrats. And that's what he did. And we, the Democrats, ended up giving him the votes on a bunch of stuff in 2024, even before the election. So he's proved agile. And, you know, here he is now this year. He was able to hold the Republicans together to pass a spending bill for the remainder of the fiscal year 2025. So he has demonstrated some skills, but he's got a real problem in that he does have a group of the people in that caucus really don't want to govern.
Well, and he owes his job to the president.
Oh, there's no doubt about that. There's no doubt about that. And because of that, he restricts the Congress's ability to be some check and balances on the executive branch. I don't think there's any doubt about that.
Let me go right to that point. I was looking at the bills that were passed by the House last week, I think. Both of these passed entirely on party lines, numbers 220 to 207 or something. One would limit judges' abilities to issue nationwide sanctions. Other would effectively surrender most congressional authority over tariffs. I doubt if either is going to pass the Senate, but both did pass the House. If the intention isn't to make law, but to make noise, that makes sense. But is that part of the problem?
Well, but I think in this case, I think the White House asked them to do this.
Oh, I'm sure.
And I doubt there's very few requests that will come from the White House that they will not take care of. I think, look, Johnson's in the position, he owes his speakership to Trump. The way it played out, Trump had to get on the phone with the last few votes he needed to become the speaker. And so, you know, if the White House says jump, Johnson's going to say how high. I mean, he's going to do whatever they request. I don't think there's any doubt about that.
Having a strong president isn't new. This one is peculiar, to put it mildly.
Yeah.
President Johnson certainly was able to get what he wanted typically from the Congress. Maybe President Carter less so. Nixon certainly got what he wanted. Was it that way when you were working with Dick? You must have had strong requests from the White House to do this or do that or not do this or that. How do you cope with those?
So, well, his one big change, when Johnson was president, there were big Democratic majorities. Most of the southern states had, you know, large Democratic constituencies of Democratic congressmen who came from the southern states. So, I mean, so they had big Democratic majorities. And the big difference today, you know, you look at the last 10 Congress is it's very, very close in terms of the margin that these leaders have. And so the decisions they make are very, very different. And, you know, and Johnson's a case in point. His speakership is owed to Trump, and he's going to have to do whatever he wants, no matter what.
Or the president would call up Dick and ask for something. How do you say no to a president?
Well, typically we would, we wouldn't do sort of show votes. In other words, I don't think we would have done what Johnson did last week with respect to injunctions by federal judges around the country. I mean, it, you know, one, because you may be putting people on a spot and you don't want to do that. And so I don't think we would do it. I mean, a lot of times the way you tell them the president no is we don't have the votes to do it. or if you're in this, you know, perhaps in the Senate, we do not have the time to do it. I, if you look back here, you've had Biden, you had Trump, and you had Bush and Obama. I mean, I don't know how many of them called their congressional leadership and said, "Hey, you got to take this vote, even though it's not gonna become law." I don't think a lot of that went on.
Which is to say that this really is a different kind of presidency.
Oh, I don't think there's any doubt about it. I don't think there's any doubt about it.
Let's switch a bit before we get to politics, straight out politics. Okay. Go ahead.
If I could just amplify a point. Look, the Republicans in Congress, both in the House and the Senate, are fearful of Trump. They're worried that Trump and Musk are going to do social messaging on them. They're worried if they don't do what the president wants, he's going to get a primary opponent. Musk has threatened to fund primary opponents against people who don't go along with the president. To be honest, and I think Senator Murkowski from Alaska made this point about a week ago, a lot of people are very fearful of retaliation from the Trump administration. And it's something she said she's never gone through before, but people are, you know, keeping their voices down because of this administration and the way they do business. So that this is a very different experience in, you know, at least when I was up there, in terms of the executive and congressional relationship.
There is a popular image, probably exaggerated, that lobbyists write bills and the lawyers write bills and congressmen and senators really are passive recipients of what others ask them to do. I remember the Gucci Gulch episodes back from the 80s. Is that cartoon or is it real?
In some cases, it's real, but I wouldn't say it's widespread. Now, here's the other thing about lobbyists in industry. In a lot of cases, the fact of the matter is they have the expertise. Now, whether or not you want them writing the legislation may be another question, but they are certainly a resource. And this is on both sides of an issue. I mean, there's an awful lot of interest on both sides of an issue. And a lot of these people have a lot of expertise and a lot more than the congressional staff as well. But does it happen? Yes, it happens. But, you know, my experience is I didn't see, I was a lobbyist too. I just didn't see it as a corrupting part of the process. I mean, I more so people were looking for expertise, and in some cases, they found it among the lobbyists.
There is a structural problem, perhaps. The stopgap spending bill that was passed in December was something like 1,600 pages. Had everything from soup to nuts. RFK Stadium was in there. Health was in there. U.S.-China was in there. It was a Christmas tree.
Correct.
How does a congressman, or for that matter, a chief of staff to a congressman, cope with a 1,600-page bill that's got to be passed before you go home to wrap presents for the kids? Does anyone read it?
Well, the congressman doesn't read it, but the staff does. And moreover, the committee staff knows what's in the bill. And they will, bring staff in and brief them and tell them what's in the bill. And the last thing they want to do, because they're trying to pass the bill, they want no surprises for members on the floor. So the fact of the matter is, members' staff get briefed on what's in these bills. And they then do a memo to the member highlighting the bill. And they will highlight, in some cases, they'll highlight, here's the things you need to think about in this bill. And, here's the other high points of the bill. So there's a lot of work that goes in terms of briefing the members. The members, you are correct, do not read the bills. They, quite frankly, they just don't have the time, but they have the staff to help them. And in addition, the committee staff want to get their bill through, and they make sure that the members' staffs are briefed on what's in the bill. you don't have a lot of bills where there's stuff and nobody knows what's going on.
But that implies there are some.
Yeah, there are some. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. But I wouldn't say that that's a lot.
Let me switch. You're a lifelong Democrat. Obviously, the party's in disarray. And I want to ask your views on that. But I want to start with something that David Hogg, who's one of the vice chairs of the DNC, said the other day, which I'm sure you saw. He said, and I quote for the audience, "We have to be a party that doesn't have a 27% approval rating from our own base. That's not survivable. The way we change that is making sure that we have some different characters running." And the way he's proposing to change it is by, I guess with his own money, $20 million to younger and more radical candidates to challenge in deeply blue seats that they think can't be lost, so that some of the old fogies in the party get booted out by some of the young fogies. How does the party regenerate itself?
So at one point I used to recruit candidates to run for the Congress. And I met a lot of people. And the recruitment process is critical to do that. But, you know, in the case where you have an incumbent and maybe an older incumbent, just because they're older doesn't mean they're effective any longer. But I think, you know, David should go out and, you know, if he can identify really good candidates, he should go out and recruit them to run. And if it be in a primary, be in a primary. But I don't see a problem with that. I guess the party chair told David yesterday or today that you're not going to be a party, have a party position if you're going to go out and recruit candidates to run against incumbents. So you got to make up your mind. But I'm all for recruiting more people to run for office with varied backgrounds. To be perfectly honest, I wish we would have had an open process when Biden announced he wasn't going to run. Now, I know there wasn't a lot of time and, you know, people said, well, we all got to get behind Harris. I would have loved to seen some of these wannabes who were thinking of running now in 28 to get into that race. And I think that would have been really interesting. And it would have been great TV, too.
An open convention would have transformed, I think, American politics, actually.
I agree. And I just think, and also I'll just tell you from the standpoint of a candidate, what you were looking at when Biden got out, what were you looking at is somebody could get a nomination within 2 or 3 months. You don't have to spend 2 years running around the country, raising money, putting together a big staff. All you probably got to do is go and do debates on a stage. And then, you know, let the convention decide what they want to do. I think it was a heck of an opportunity for a lot of people. And, nobody made that decision. That's what they want to do.
And that lack of a decision was a decision with all sorts of obvious consequences.
You know, I'm hopeful that we're going to see a lot of different people run in 28. And I think we have some, you know, governors out there and some others who could potentially be very good candidates. And the truth is, you know, whoever wins that is going to define the party, going to define what they're going to run on. And it's going to define, basically, you're going to have a new reincarnation of the party, depending upon who wins the primary in 28. And I just hope we have a lot of people get into this.
Before we get to 28, we got to get to 26. But in the way too early to ask questions, what do you think might happen in 26?
26 is a midterm election. And all midterm elections, for the most part, are a referendum on the incumbent in the White House. Trump, when he ran in 18, he ended up losing a bunch of seats. And the truth of the matter is the number one indicator to keep an eye on is what the president's approval rating is going into the the 26 election. That will basically define who ends up winning that election. And, you know, as it stands now in the House, there's about 40 competitive House seats, 22 Democrats, 18 Republicans. And you have about, of the Republicans in those, you have 13 of them who won in districts that Harris won. And on the Democratic side, you had 3 Democrats who won in districts that Trump won. So, you know, the House will be very, you know, very, very competitive. Typically, and, you know, and with Trump, it's a little unique, too. Whenever Trump is not on the ballot, Republicans don't do as well. And you can look at all the special elections. You can look at his midterm election in 18. You can look at all the special elections. And then you can also look at, most recently, a month ago, the Supreme Court race in Wisconsin. Trump wasn't on the ballot. Musk goes in and spends all this money, and the Democrat candidate one-handedly. So that's another thing to keep an eye on. But the main predictor of that election is going to be what Trump's approval rating is the fall of 26.
Let me pull on just one of those threads. You pointed out Wisconsin, where tons of money was spent. For that matter, Harris raised $1 billion in a very short period of time and spent like a drunken sailor. One of the things that may be happening, which I would think is optimistic, is money may not matter as much in elections as it did, as it has done, partially because of social media, for all sorts of other reasons. But there might be something going on that says, no, money doesn't have to drive elections. Other things can drive elections. Is that too optimistic?
No. So here's the other thing. The other thing about particularly big races, to a less extent, maybe the House races, but in the Senate, the gubernatorial, and the presidential, candidates could raise significant amounts of money on social media. And what that means is they don't have to run around doing all these fundraisers. They're basically sending out messages on the social media, and they're raising money off of the messages. And I think that's a really positive thing, because they're not spending as much money. They're not spending as much time going around raising money. And I also think it's just, it gives them more time to campaign and do other things. And so I think it's a very positive thing that they're able to do that. I mean, look, me personally, I'd rather have public financing. And we did at one point in the presidential, but we don't know any longer, really. Nobody's gone along with it. But it's the same problem I have with the congressional races, you know, particularly in the House. They have to spend a lot of money raising money. I mean, these congressional races now are costing $4, 5, 6 million. And it takes a lot of time to raise that kind of money. The Senate races are, you know, 20, 30, 40, maybe 50, 60 million. I mean, in the Senate race, Sherrod Brown versus Moreno, the amount of money that was spent, it was obscene. So I personally would rather see us have a public financing. But it's very hard to see that happening. But I think it is a good thing, though. They're able to raise more money off the internet and social media.
Do you know leaders who, regardless of where they live or what they do, are changing the world? Leaders who are not content with what is and are working hard for what could be. Leaders with both a demonstrated track record and the potential for continued impact. Leaders whose work is innovative, courageous, rooted in universal values, and global in approach or implication. If so, please nominate them for the Telberg SNF Eliason Global Leadership Prize at telbergprize.org. The nominations will be open from March 15th to May 15th. Thank you. Let's segue back. There are a number of questions about Congress versus the executive, about the president's grabbing powers from the Congress. When and how will the Congress stand up and assert itself? To be more precise, as a bad example, perhaps, if the president were to defy the Supreme Court, Andrew Jackson time, he literally says, I don't care what you did. I got an army. You don't have one. I'm not going to obey that. Yep. Would the Congress impeach?
Yep. My sense is that would be a deal breaker. And just remember, in terms of impeachment, the Democrats would need 4 Republicans to go along with them in the House, or 5, to get the majority, and they could do an impeachment resolution. And then, you know, it becomes more difficult. You got to get 2/3 in the Senate for it to convict. But to get an impeachment resolution, you know, you get 4 or 5 Republicans in the House. My sense is that could potentially happen if he were to defy the Supreme Court. And I would also expect to see, four Republicans to join with the Democrats, and they could take control back of the Senate. I mean, if they got so mad that he defied the Supreme Court, I mean, you could take the majority. I mean, these margins are so close, so it influences everything. But I think there'd be a possibility that if he goes that far and defies the court, I think he's going to, I would assume he's going to have some problems there.
The Republicans in Congress may be scared of Trump if they stand up for constitutional processes. However, if the alternative is to lose the constitutional authority, how do you think history will judge them? Which is implicit in the answer you just gave. You think some actually may understand history matters.
Oh, yeah. Well, so here's the other thing. Let's suppose some don't want to worry about history, but let's suppose all they're caring about is keeping their House or Senate seat. And let's suppose they're up for re-election in 26. They may decide that if I'm going to stay in the House, the only way I'm going to be able to do it is I got to go join the Democrats, because this is going to be a bloodbath in 26 if he's defying the Supreme Court. There's no way I'm going to be able to hold a seat. And that's why I think, so that is not only, are they worried about the constitutional issues, but they're also worried about their personal situation. Can they hold that seat if he's defying the court? And if they come back with the answer no, then, you know, what am I doing? Am I going to switch, or am I just going to go and lose, or am I going to quit?
Well, defying the court is the nuclear winter kind of scenario.
Yeah, I would expect.
Let's go short of that. So we don't get to Andrew Jackson time, but we do have him, for example, consistently poaching on territory that traditionally is much more Congress's. Put aside that Congress has given up way too much power over the years, correct, voluntarily to the executive. But correct, whether it be tariffs, whether it be sanctions, whether it be a whole series of things, clearly this White House is pushing the boundary more and more. And the courts may or may not eventually catch up with all that, but that takes a long time. Are there, in other words, I'm asking, short of nuclear winter,
yep,
actually defying the court,
yep,
which a smart president would avoid anyhow, are there conditions such that, in your view, the Congress would either begin to act more aggressively, or your alternative, politically, people start leaving a ship that looks like it might sink dramatically in 26?
Yeah, there's part of me that thinks that if they think the ship is going to sink, that may be almost more of a motivator, unfortunately. I mean, I would like to think that the current, you know, Article 1 of the Constitution, the power of the purse, spending and taxes and tariffs, excises, and, you know, that the Congress hasn't done anything. Although Grassley co-sponsored a bill in the Senate, which they passed, him and Cantwell, but Johnson says he won't take it up in the House to, you know, basically say Congress has got to approve all these tariffs. Although you don't really need a bill, that's in the law, that they have to. But you know, you have a speaker in the House who's beholden to the president, and there's no way he's going to, you know, allow any of that type of legislation to come to the floor of the House. Then the only way you can do it is you got to do a discharge petition. Whereas you get 218, a majority of the House. And if there's a bill that's been in a committee and it hasn't come out and you get 218 signatures, you can actually bring it to the floor for a vote. And to, don't be surprised. I mean, the discharge in the last Congress was used more than ever before. And I'm familiar with it because I used a discharge petition back in 2015 to get a trade bill through the Congress. And so they'll look for other maneuvers to do that. But I think, you know, because nobody's done anything now, I just don't know if on the fact that, you know, they're going to keep making the spending decisions at the White House. Although I would say they're moving a little in the Congress's direction. A rescission bill is going to come to the floor, I think, in the House in the next few weeks. And that's basically based upon a lot of the cuts that Musk has proposed.
And explain a rescission bill.
So a rescission bill is the president decides to rescind funds that have been appropriated by the Congress. And the nice thing about a rescission bill is it only requires a majority in both the House and the Senate. And so if they get a majority, the president then can go ahead and, you know, rescind the funds for that program that he specifies in the legislation with those amounts. And so they're looking, and this is, you know, basically dealing with a number of the things that Musk has come up with. It's not going to be a large bill, but they're going to start rescinding the money because Congress hasn't approved any of these cuts yet. But this is the first step, I think, on the part of the administration to say, okay, well, you know, we'll send you a rescission, and, you know, that will rubber stamp what we've done.
There is a big, beautiful bill, as the president calls it, a coming. We know we need a tax bill this year. The administration has already asked for, and the Congress has signaled that they would do it through reconciliation, which I'm going to ask you to explain.
Sure.
That process, but also to talk a bit about how you think that whole tax fight is going to go down, because it does become. It was what I would have thought would have been the centerpiece of the legislative year, but all this other stuff has already taken place.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think to the detriment of the tax bill, all this other stuff has taken place. So let's start with the reconciliation bill. It is a process that expedites legislation that deals with taxes, spending, or the debt limit. And it expedites it by only requiring a simple majority in the Senate. In the Senate, most of the business in the Senate is done by getting cloture and to prevent the filibuster, and you need 60 votes. And so, you know, here we have the Senate now is 53 Republican, 47 Democrats. If they had to get 60 votes for this tax bill, it would probably never occur. However, under the reconciliation process, they're only going to need 51. You know, they think they'll probably have a shot at that. But a lot of big spending or tax bills are done using the reconciliation process. For example, when Obamacare was done, it was done in the Senate under the reconciliation process because all they needed were 51 votes for it, rather than the normal for most legislation in the Senate, you need 60. So that's sort of what reconciliation does. And so this tax bill, there's two pieces to it. One is they want to take the tax cuts they had in the 2017 bill, which totaled about $4.7 trillion over 10 years. And they want to put that in this bill. And then the president has wants to give tax cuts for people overtime work, no taxes for tips, people who work in restaurants, tips. And then also he wants to stop taxing Social Security benefits. Now, the interesting thing, the first two, tips and overtime, isn't that expensive. But if you start take away the taxes people pay for Social Security benefits, you're talking about probably another $5 trillion. So you're talking—
Over 10 years.
So, the total package that has been estimated would be about $11.7 trillion. Over 10 years for that, if that's what they end up with. Okay. In order to do that, you have to get pay-fors. And the House has come up with pay-fors of about, $5 trillion they're talking about.
And just to interrupt, pay for means you've got to find offsetting revenues. Correct.
Yeah. In other words, you have to pay for it. You have to get cuts. You have to pay for it. So the House has come up with, because they have one caucus in the House, they're all worried about the deficit, and they should be. I mean, this is a problem we should deal with in a bipartisan way. We're not going to do it, but let me tell you, this is something we need to deal with. But the House wants to come up with pay-fors. The Senate, on the other hand, has come up with a maneuver called current policy baseline. Basically, they're making the case that because this is current law, we don't have to do anything in terms of the budget on this. You know, this is just current law. We have it now. We're going to continue it. So we don't have to come up with pay-fors because it's current law. But I think that accounting maneuver is unlikely to pass. So what they're basically suggesting is we don't want to pay for anything in terms of these tax cuts. And I think it's very unlikely that the parliamentarian would ever approve that. As a matter of fact, the parliamentarian, apparently there were discussions, and then the Republicans said, well, we don't want an answer from the parliamentarian now. My sense is they probably got an answer. They didn't like the answer. So then the question is whether or not they would have a motion to question the decision by the parliamentarian. And if that were to happen, that would also be a nuclear strike in the Senate. So you have tax cuts, and then how are you going to pay for it? And this is going to be very difficult to come up with that money. And the truth of the matter is, if you're going to get funding to pay for it, you're going to have to hit some, probably Medicare and Medicaid, and a bunch of other programs. And that's going to be very, very tough for Republican members to make that case back home.
Let me draw the bottom line on that. Some of it was a little arcane, all important. But it really means that passing this tax bill is going to be a fight to the death. Not passing the tax bill, which is now becoming at least possible, if not likely, would mean a very large tax increase, undoing the 2017 tax cuts, which would surely send the economy into a tailspin, and it's probably already headed that way. Can you imagine the Congress failing that badly to legislate?
That's a very good question. They're going to have to pick their poison. Either they go along with the Senate maneuver somehow, and maybe that the parliamentarian would go along with that, and so they don't really have to pay for it, or they're going to have to make drastic cuts to these programs that have an awful lot of support, and they're going to be in a very, very tough situation because of that. I think it's going to be very, very difficult, but you've, if they don't do this, people are going to get tax increases. And so I think somehow they're going to find a way to deal with this. But understand, keep an eye on this. There's a caucus in the House that will not go along without paying for all this stuff. So they're either going to have to slim it down or they're going to have to take away some of the tax cuts.
And to underline the swim it down, you can't swim it down the Elon Musk way because those may or may not be good cuts. Put that aside.
Yep.
They're tiny cuts.
Yeah, 40% of the federal budget is Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. And then defense is another 13% or so.
Let me circle back a bit because this is where Profiles in Courage comes to mind.
Go ahead.
At the end of last year, it was in January, Senator Schumer flipped and voted, in fact, to keep the government open and was pilloried for doing it from his left.
Not correct. Right.
Question to you as an observer of the Congress and as a Democrat, what message does that send to others in the House and the Senate if they want to do what you guys used to do and what Dick famously did was, at the end of the day, work for the national interest?
I guess I'm not sure if the Republicans, they had to do the spending bill for the rest of the fiscal year 25. The Republicans wrote the bill. And in matter of fact, in that bill, they basically said, we're not going to allow any votes on tariffs. The president can do whatever he wants. They didn't give the Democrats one thing. And I don't think you can, you know, and even though if there was a potential shutdown, I'm not sure I would go along with that just basically because they're going to threaten me with a shutdown, but they're not going to help anything I want to try to get done in this bill as well. I mean, I'm not sure I'd go along with that.
And the odds that kind of question is going to be put again are near perfect.
Yes. Oh, there's no doubt about it. Here's the other thing I would say. In December, when they did the continuing resolution in the House, they knew they may get to a point later on, i.e. in March, that they're in that situation, that the Republicans put together a bill, they don't give us anything, and what are we going to do? And I think the Democrats would have been better off of, you know, having a strategy then, and executing that strategy before they got to March. And, you know, for whatever reason, they didn't. And I think that made it difficult for them and put them in a tough position. But I'm not so sure, it was the best thing to do.
Let me pull on that thread, because what you've effectively said is they kicked the can.
Correct.
I played that when we were kids.
Correct.
They kicked the can, and they're going to have to face the same issue.
Correct.
But they will have all the scar tissue they're accumulating now, both from their constituents, but also from their colleagues and from the president. So their room to maneuver gets less and less. But you're saying if you were advising someone, you'd actually think about, you got to stand up sometime.
Yeah. But so let me give you a concrete example. 1990, George H.W. Bush is president, and he ran in 88 and went to the convention, talked no new taxes.
Read my lips.
All right. So we were talking to Bush, the congressional leadership. And they were going back and forth. And the Democrats said, look, we'll do a big deal with you to deal with the deficit, but we got to have everything on the table. We know what you said. And Bush made a courageous decision. And when they went out to do the announcement that we're going to go to a summit and everything will be on the table, you know, he said to Gephardt, he said, Dick, the fat's in the fire. And we had a negotiation. Both sides had to come up with stuff they didn't want to. Democrats are a bunch of program cuts we didn't want to do. You know, the Republicans certainly didn't want to give up on the taxes. But we ended up going to Andrews Air Force Base and had a summit for about 3 weeks or so and put together a plan. And Gephardt was the leader negotiator for the Democrats, and Dick Darman was for the administration. And we ended up with a deal. And then we ended up passing it. And the day we passed it on the House floor, one of the clerks of the floor, I was standing with Dick, came up to me and said, Mr. Gephardt, Mr. Darman's in the speaker's lobby. He'd like to talk to you. And so Dick said, come on, let's go see Darman. So we go out there, and Darman and Dick hug and say, we did the right thing for the country. Both sides gave, you know, and it was just unbelievable. That's why I say when you can get this stuff done, it's majestic. And it's hard to do.
I'm tempted to end right there, but I can't help but ask the obvious question.
Yeah.
Fast forward 3 decades later.
Yep.
And we're sitting here with, you know, it's black outside. There's a hurricane coming. There's a snowstorm coming. There's intense heat coming. Yep. All that stuff. Can we do it? First, can we do it again? That's too easy. How do we get back to a place as a country where that can happen again? Who has to do what? Is it the people? Is it all of us encourage our kids to run for office? Is it start thinking differently about politics? Is it how do we get back? How do we get back to the future?
My sense, I think you hit on, I think it's all of us. I don't think we can necessarily expect, and we'd like to, but I don't know if we necessarily expect, you know, all the leaders, you know, to do this. I think it's got to come up from the grassroots, and we got to change expectations of what we expect the government to do, and you know what we really need to address. Look. Bush's leadership was unbelievable. It's just unbelievable. And I don't know if we've had that, you know, that kind of leadership since then. But I do know that we have politicians in offices now. And I know we have a whole lot of individuals in this country that would do the same thing Bush did. But people have to get engaged. And they have to change the expectations of what they have of their government and their government officials. I think I still believe in this country and the opportunity it's given so many people that we can continue that legacy. But we got to make some changes in the way we do business.
The title of the session is Does Congress Matter? The last comment has to be at the Congress. Do you think the Congress will do its part?
I definitely think if the president were to defy the Supreme Court, I think the Congress would do its part. And I also think if the political situation were to continue to worsen for the Republicans, I think that would force the hand of the Congress as well.
Let's leave it there. Thank you very much, Tom, for the conversation, for your experience.
Thanks, Alan.
Thank you for listening to this episode of New Thinking for a New World. I'm Alan Stoga, podcast host, and I look forward to your joining our next conversation. Remember, tell us what you think at telbergfoundation.org.